Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the nuclear summit in South Korea and speak with Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. We'll discuss President Obama's visit to the DMZ and the uninvited guest in the North whose leader is planning a deal-breaking missile test. Then, as demonstrations mobilize across the country expressing outrage over the killing of a black teenager, Trayvon Martin, by George Zimmerman, an armed, self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer who so far has been protected by Florida's Stand Your Ground law, we'll be joined by Executive Director of Color of Change, Rashad Robinson. He'll discuss the growing pressure to have George Zimmerman arrested and charged. Then finally, we'll get an update on Syria and discuss the mission by the former head of the UN, Kofi Annan, that the Russian president said is the last chance to avoid a prolonged and bloody civil war in Syria. We'll get a reaction from an important member of the Syrian opposition, Radwan Ziadeh, about this so-called diplomatic track and the extent to which there already is a war underway in Syria. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
And the president's in South Korea. They're about to get underway with the nuclear summit. It seems to me that it's not just the subtext of the nuclear summit, but pretty much the subject of the nuclear summit is nuclear proliferation, and there are two countries very much in the spotlight there: Iran, who are not attending, and North Korea, just across the border, who are also not attending. Would you agree that it's a bit of a coincidence that they're so close to North Korea, the subject of all of the hand-wringing?
Well, you know, this is an important international summit. Leaders from over 50 countries are now convening in Seoul, South Korea, today for the second nuclear security summit. The purported agenda of the summit is preventing nuclear terrorism and safeguarding nuclear material. But to the host, the South Korean president, as well as the featured guest, if you will, President Obama, as well as other leaders with a stake in Korea and the region, North Korea's preparations for a satellite launch next month and also the recalcitrant country's two-decades-old nuclear problem will be the dominant theme. North Korea has a way of turning the spotlight on itself and also raining on South Korea's parade. When you have a big international event like this, usually North Korea does something to spoil the fun for the South Koreans. And we know that North Korea reneged on a late February agreement to put a moratorium on its missile and nuclear testing. 2 weeks later, North Korea declared to the world that it will actually launch a satellite using long-range missile technology in mid-April. So President Obama and President Lee of South Korea have much on their minds.
Well, the launch or the reneging on the deal in the North is a part of a pattern, isn't it? Because that followed shortly thereafter when an agreement was made, and essentially a food for nukes agreement, and this was a part of the agreement. So that seems to be the pattern, that the North Koreans make an agreement and then immediately do something that would break the agreement.
Well, you know, the idiom, the expression carrot and stick, you know, this is something that North Korea has very effectively used against much more powerful adversaries, principally the U.S. For over 50 years now, North Korea sees itself as the party wielding the proverbial carrot and stick, and us as the uncooperative donkey, if you will. And this has been a constant theme in North Korean strategy, to strike when the adversary is distracted, least expecting it, or mired in bigger events like wars, and then sue for negotiations, change the atmospherics with a view toward receiving greater economic and political concessions. One might wonder, if this is the case, then why did North Korea take the trouble to agree to freeze its nuclear missile program last month, and also send a high-ranking top official to the United States in early March to preach the message that the new leadership in Pyongyang seeks better relations with the United States. The reason is, as far as I can tell, better relations in North Korean parlance means not necessarily the dismantlement of its weapons program in return for short-term aid, but it really means bigger investments continually flowing into the Kim regime's palace economy, following another provocative act and then yet another pledge of abstinence. So by leaving open the window of opportunity for future talks and creating the illusion of some power struggle going on between odds and hawks in government, this is a common ruse designed to cater to Western tastes that the Kim regime picked up from the Soviets and the Chinese under Chairman Mao Zedong. North Korea seeks to carry on the cycle of provocation, negotiation, and concessions.
So, but isn't there another aspect operating here? Sung Yoon Lee, again, professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Don't the North Koreans themselves, the people, and particularly the leadership, and the people have been in some indoctrinated to believe that they are the center of the world, they're a special person, and they're special people, and they are their leader really is in effect a global leader, even though to us he may seem somewhat ridiculous and presiding over a country of starving people, yet he has a sort of some kind of a nascent nuclear program. Isn't it true that he sees himself and those around him and his people see him as a global leader?
Absolutely. North Korea is so unique in bizarre ways. I from time to time, say North Korea is uniquely unique. I realize that's not proper English, but it is the world's only communist hereditary dynasty, which is, of course, a contradiction in a communist state. To have a father-to-son succession twice now, this is unheard of. North Korea is also unique in that it is the world's only industrialized, literate, peacetime society to have experienced a major food catastrophe, a famine, which still reverberates in present-day North Korea some 15 years after the fact. So North Korea has a lot of problems, and it has weaknesses, vulnerabilities. Yes, it has a small nuclear arsenal, it has a large conventional army. By its geographical location, it has the capability to wreak havoc on South Korea and Japan, two major allies of the United States. Yet, it has real weaknesses, pressure points, which are acute poverty. North Korea is one of the poorest countries in the world. The regime's dependence on illicit activity like selling fake pharmaceuticals and fake U.S. $100 bills and so forth. And also the enforced isolation as well as immiseration of its own people. You have tens of thousands of North Koreans taking great risk to escape their repressive country with the view toward resettling in that far more attractive, far more successful other Korean state across the border, South Korea. So the regime faces some serious long-term problems.
Well, Professor Sung Yoon Lee, President Obama visited the DMZ and said he felt he was in a time warp. It's not the first president that we've had that same photo op looking with the binoculars across at the North. He's also said that North Korea needs to understand that bad behavior will not be rewarded. So I suppose there's no point in speculating about this missile test. They'll go ahead and do it, won't they? They don't normally cancel things.
Right. President Obama, as you say, not the first U.S. president to visit the DMZ. We have still close to 28,000 or so U.S. soldiers stationed in South Korea. And it's not the importance of the presence of the U.S. troops in South Korea. It's not so much how many, the numbers, but the powerful symbolism of being there right in harm's way. These are frontline soldiers, and they will be among the first to pay a price if there is another war or North Korean invasion. And that has been a strong deterrent to another war on the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War, now almost 60 years ago. So there's symbolism in President Obama's visit. He told the troops that you are at the frontier of freedom. And I think that is a very pithy and a powerful message. The difference in freedom, in basic liberties, in the standard of living between North Korea and South Korea could not be starker. And the two countries were, of course, united 65 years ago. In 1945, the peninsula was divided. So you look at the Korean Peninsula today and you see a story of traumatic success in terms of nation building and a model failed state in North Korea.
Well, but I think in what you've just told us, there's another way to look at it, that the U.S., those 28,000 U.S. soldiers who the president said are on the frontier of freedom or on freedom's frontier, they're also hostages to any this kind of tripwire. We've had some incidents, the sinking of a warship, the shelling of a South Korean island. There's a massive deployment on that border of conventional weapons in the north. I don't know what kind of a nuclear arsenal they have, but if the north were ever to attack in any serious way, I'm absolutely certain that the U.S. would use nuclear weapons. So isn't that what the subtext is here? And after all, this talk, this summit that's taking place with 54 world leaders is about nuclear proliferation, I assume, also avoiding nuclear war. So I guess in a way they couldn't have chosen a better place.
Well, I'm not sure that the U.S. would be it would be politically feasible for any U.S. administration to resort to nuclear weapons in the event of another war with North Korea. During the Korean War over 60 years ago, this was a serious issue, and all the allies, including Britain and France, the 15 other nations that came under the banner of the UN to defend South Korea under U.S. Initiative, they were all against it. And I think it would be even more difficult to use nuclear weapons on an adversary today. But as you say, yes, the presence of the U.S. troops they do serve as a tripwire. And this is a slightly invidious term. You know, it's it accurately suggests that the American soldiers will be the first to be sacrificed. At the same time, you know, that sends a strong message to North Korea that the U.S., more than honoring any agreement on paper or resorting to lofty rhetoric, will be seriously retaliating in the case of a North Korean invasion. And to my mind, that has been the strongest deterrent, the single greatest factor in keeping the peace in Korea over the past 60 years. This year, North Korea says it is the year when North Korea all of a sudden becomes so-called powerful and prosperous country. And they've been saying this since the late 90s. Their claim to being a powerful and prosperous country is based on the sole fact that this year, 2012, is the 100th year anniversary of the birth of the founding dictator, the founder of the dynasty, Kim Il-sung, who died in 1994. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the new regime, now just 3 months old, the young Kim Jong-un regime, the son that took over in the wake of his father's death 3 months ago, they have a lot to prove. The young man has a lot to prove. He has a lot of incentives to come across as a military strategist, to be audacious, and also to supply basic necessities to his own people, because the regime has been promising the people that this is a miraculous year. And in that aspect, in terms of the past, the best bet would be to provoke once again, to go through with this missile test in mid-April, perhaps carry out another nuclear test, and then super negotiations. And in the past, that's worked very well for this poor country that has nuclear weapons.
Well, not to get it sidetracked here, Professor Sung Yun Lee, into a military strategy, but one would think that given the 28,000 U.S. troops there and the South Korean military and the enormous numbers on the north side, that if there were to be an attack, and they've shown indications of willingness to provoke, not a full-scale attack, I would have thought that if those U.S. soldiers were quickly overrun, then Seoul is within artillery range. A lot of South Koreans, I understand, still refuse to believe that the North Koreans were behind the sinking of the warship. Do you think that it would remain a conventional war? For that, in other words, the U.S. and the South Korea could contain a North Korean attack. I'm not suggesting it's about to happen, but just on paper, I would have thought that nuclear weapons were the subtext.
Right. Well, I guess in the world of sports, one really doesn't know which team in baseball or football or what have you will win, even if it's a team far stronger on paper. That's why you play the game. In international politics, the objective is not to play that game. So overwhelming military superiority is a most comforting thing. And in the case of the balance of power on the Korean Peninsula over the past 60 years, the commitment of the United States to defend the South and even threaten North Korea that the U.S. Will consider using nuclear weapons. This has been an effective strategy. Will North Korea invade? Well, anything's possible, of course, but we know that North Korea is not suicidal. They are not jihadists, if you will. And over the past 60 years, they've really, with impunity, attacked and killed a number of American soldiers and hundreds of thousands of South Koreans. And the latest examples that you cited, sinking of the South Korean warship in March of 2010 and the shelling of an inhabited island later that year in November, these are just two recent examples. During the Cold War, you know, they shot down a U.S. spy plane, killing all 31 servicemen, U.S. servicemen on board. They hacked to death U.S. soldiers. They ambushed and shot U.S. patrol guards and so forth. And each time, they never really paid any kind of penalty. My point is, North Korea resorts to provocations to achieve its goals, but these are limited attacks, and North Korea assumes that it can get away with it. North Korea has never attacked. You know, it from time to time threatens to make Seoul, the capital of South Korea, into a sea of flame, but it has never done anything like that because that would call for retaliation. The sailors who died, 46 of them, were, after all, military men. It's very impolite to say so, but in South Korea, the South Korean public's been so conditioned to the prosperity that they've enjoyed over the past generation, the public will not support strong retaliation against North Korea, even in the wake of the sinking of the warship and the killing of 46 sailors or the death of four on the island.
Hello, you're still there?
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead. You're saying...
North Korea is very...
Hello? Did we lose you? There you are.
Likelihood of a full-scale invasion is quite low.
Well, I just bring this up because in 1994, apparently, under President Clinton, there was a U.S. came close to war with North Korea. Korea, to the extent that Jimmy Carter, former president, went over there on his own dime, if you will, as a special envoy to try and ease things up. So even though, obviously, it's not likely, it's still possible. I didn't mean to sidetrack the conversation, but...
Right. The U.S. certainly, during the Clinton administration, the U.S. certainly had a contingency plan for surgical strikes on North Korea's nuclear facilities. And in the end, though, you know, it's one thing to have a contingency plan. It's another thing to implement that plan. And politically, it was determined not feasible to resort to that contingency plan. And yes, former President Jimmy Carter, on his own, engaged in some freelance diplomacy and changed the atmospherics for the better when he visited Pyongyang in June 1994. That's true. But, you know, if the North Koreans were so afraid of U.S.-led air attack or any kind of military retaliation, one has to wonder how, you know, emboldened they are to first threaten the world, the United States, that they will go ahead with a missile launch in mid-April, just weeks after having signed on to an agreement on missile testing moratorium. And they've really added insult to injury in the past. That is, they conducted a seven-missile barrage, testing of seven missiles, including a long-range missile, on the 4th of July, as Americans were celebrating Independence Day in 2006. They also tested their second nuclear, they conducted their second nuclear test on May 25th, 2009, Memorial Day in the United States. And these are not coincidences. North Korea really likes to add insult to injury. So I think North Koreans, just based on track record, feel quite either complacent or confident that the U.S. will resort to crisis management or damage control diplomacy instead of military action.
Well, I think you've, I mean, we actually haven't talked much about the nuclear summit. I suppose it just, it sounds, given that Iran and North Korea are both the subjects, I should think, of much of the discussion. In the case of Iran, of course, there's talk of an Israeli preemptive strike. The president's tried to restrain the Israelis, and maybe the U.S. is planning on doing something after the election. And, you know, we just talked a little while ago about Clinton's contingency plan to do a preemptive strike. Given the failure of diplomacy in terms of persuading countries like Iran and North Korea to give up their nuclear programs, then it's not unreasonable to assume that that's a valid option being considered. Not that I in any way approve of it or think it's rational or and believe it would be counterproductive, but nevertheless, it seems to be a reality, right?
Well, I'm afraid so, because in history, no nuclear weapons possessing state, that is, that had acquired actual nuclear weapons, have ever given them up voluntarily, negotiated them away for any kind of concessions without a change in the leadership. Now, South Africa in 1989 had a new leader and a new regime, had a political will, an opportunity to reorient itself toward the West, the U.S. and Western Europe. The same with the former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus, that inherited Soviet nuclear weapons in the early 90s, negotiated them away. It's a very difficult proposition, of course. I mean, you know, to think that any party or power could negotiate with the U.S., persuade the U.S. to get rid of its nuclear arsenal, or China, or Britain, or any other country, would be almost a laughable proposition. But in the case of North Korea, because North Korea is so poor and backward, many people have assumed that it was possible. But another way of looking at that would be, because North Korea is so poor and backward and faces a great existential challenge in the existence of that successful other Korea, without nuclear weapons, you know, what would it have after it gives them away and receives billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, and a lot of money and food and fuel? What would it do after all those blandishments dry up? Depend on the goodwill of its neighbors? That would be a very poor national policy.
So, well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I really appreciate you coming on today here, Professor Sung Yoon Lee.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sung Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about national mobilizations against the killing of Trayvon Martin and calls for the George Zimmerman, the killer, to be put on trial. Walk through the empty streets. There's something constant under my feet. But all the news reports recommended I stay indoors. Because the air outside will make a soul divided at an alarming rate. De la chance it becomes.